ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. Having nearly rid Kangaroo Island of feral cats, brave local councillors are now talking tough about clearing the island of the most protected animals on Earth, pet cats. At stake is the survival of bandicoots, little penguins, echidnas, whipbirds. The list is long. Later in the show, we explore the last cat policy of Kangaroo Island. The Odyssey is about everything, of course. Love, loss, enchantment, homecoming, conquest, etc., etc., etc. Even colonisation, which is an irony not enjoyed by the Sahrawi people of occupied Western Morocco, where Christopher Nolan took his IMAX cameras for a few days to film his Odyssey. Later, the stink around the Morocco location. But first, to Ian Dunt, columnist with iNews, co-host of the Origin Story podcast, our man in the United Kingdom. Ian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much indeed.
Ian, I read with some distress news that Binface is only getting about 20% of the vote in Clacton-on-Sea, and Farage is currently running at 73%. It looks as though Binface doesn't have a chance.
Yes. I think people might have gotten a little bit carried away here. Like, none of us were expecting, I can't believe I'm even saying these words out loud. None of us were expecting Count Binface to win the by-election. Because it's, you know, there's a reason that Farage triggered a vote in his own constituency, which is it's his stronghold. And reliably, voters there tend to show up for him and tend to give him the benefit of the doubt. And he thought he could win there in pretty much any circumstance. And it even seems that running against a man who thinks that he's an alien with a rubbish bin on his head is insufficient probably to beat him. So the early polling, and by the way, you've got to take all the polling with a pinch of salt. You know, it's constituency polling, so it can be very, very tough to do. It's only a few hundred people. It's on the phone.
Yes, yes.
You get sorted results on the phone. There's all sorts of caveats you've got to put around it. But nevertheless, it looks like Farage will win, which we were expecting. This is the problem. It's the expectation game. That ultimately, at the beginning of this thing, we thought if Farage comes out with like a significantly reduced turnout and struggles to win against a BIM, then that is about as bad an outcome for him as you can possibly imagine, especially when you consider that he's then going to have the parliamentary investigation into his donations, more and more stories coming out every week, his own version of events just doesn't make any kind of sense. And then, depending on the outcome of that inquiry, although we are expecting it to be pretty severe, he would then have to have another by-election if there's a recall petition against him, where he'd have to fight this all over again. So you just sort of think, like, how much can you take? This is supposed to be one of a flurry of blows. It's not supposed to be the knockout blow. The trouble is, because people started, and again, this sounds so preposterous, but I have to say it because it's the truth, because people started saying Count Binface could win, it sort of reset expectations weirdly in Farage's favor and made it seem like any victory by him would be enough to sort of put the dogs to bed.
Yes, yes, yes. But certainly from a distance, the Count is making Farage look stupid. And I don't know whether that's also the impression in Britain. Farage looks a much lesser figure because of this jape.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. He just looks preposterous. Like, not so long ago, at the beginning of this year, when he was able to control the narrative, he would hold these weekly press conferences. He stopped doing that, although he did another one this week. He stopped doing that. But during those press conferences, it was framed as if he was basically about to become prime, as if he was on the verge of becoming prime minister. The press would all attend, no matter where, no matter when, no matter how many times he did it, they would report with solemnity the policies that he was saying he was going to put in place. And all of that, of course, had a huge impact. When he said, we're going to pull out of net zero, we're going to get rid of all these investments, it actually slowed the auctions that you would have for wind power, for solar power, for offshore, for onshore. So all of it was really very, very damaging indeed. Now you fast forward, he's basically pursued constantly by these financial stories. He has spent months now basically shouting at a human bin, walking around his constituency, looking like the butt of a joke. It's exactly as you just put it. He's gone from something serious to something ludicrous through a scheme of his own devising. I mean, he created the scenario in which this takes place. So yeah, again, even in that, even if he does get 73%, which I'm not sure he will, even then, this is going to be a very, very negative outcome for him indeed.
Ian, what's the worst he can face if the inquiry into the donations that he's accepted finds that he has failed to disclose them? That's the only offence, isn't it? I mean, receiving the money is not an offence. Failing to disclose it is the problem, isn't it?
That's correct. There's not, but there's two separate stories, ultimately. There's one which is about the $5 million that he was given, which was a gift, and it's supposedly in a personal capacity, and he can do what he likes with. And his argument there is, well, look, at that point, I wasn't a politician. I didn't think I was going to run for parliament. That's becoming a more complicated argument for him to make now. I mean, it was anyway a pretty tenuous one. This guy was always a politician. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, he was ever just leading this private life over here. Politician, obviously. But now the stories coming out seem to indicate that there were early meetings between him and his allies from before this donation, when he was organizing how he was going to come into parliament. I mean, it's really almost impossible for him to consistently tell this story. There's then another story, which is about his relationship with this guy, Posh George, who you and I spoke about a month ago.
Yes.
He's a sort of very colorful character, the guy that was always next to him, young, baby-faced aristocrat, constantly smoking cigarettes. And there, I mean, we're seeing these patterns. The latest government Guardian reporting shows these patterns of, like, you know, this guy, Posh George, sends a bunch of money to his mum. His mum then makes these donations to reform. I mean, it's a different inquiry and it's a different set of issues. Both of them look equally damaging. And at the end of it, look, this is not a police investigation. This is a parliamentary inquiry. And what they would recommend is how many days you are suspended from the House, if any at all. How many days you're thrown out of the Commons. Now, after a certain period of time, if you're thrown out for any longer than a set period of time, you then have the power to have a recall petition. It was a law introduced by David Cameron in 2010. And it basically says that constituents can organize a petition. And if a set number of people in the constituency say they want a recall petition, you go to another by-election. You have to run to save your seat. And that is, at the moment, the most likely outcome. We're talking about really severe things. People really hate Farage, even in a seat where he's popular. A small group of people really, really dislike him. So it's very likely that we will have that second by-election in a few months' time.
As you mentioned a few moments ago. Now, look, no more about Farage, because there's rather an important thing that's happened in the United Kingdom. I understand you have a new Prime Minister, and you've written in quite glowing terms about the businesslike way in which he has got down to work. A professional political operation, and I'm quoting you here, operating in a professional fucking way. Now, explain how that operates in number 10.
Yeah, so, I mean, first, look, the problem that we've always had with number 10 is that it's too small because it's in a house.
Do they really work in that house? I mean, I'd assume that was a front for some enormous public service, civil service building somewhere, but they really work in there.
No, because what you've just described is a rational way of organising government, which lacks sentimentality and nostalgia and an almost pathological view of your own national past.
My mistake.
Yeah, no, that's a significant error there. So we are deeply sentimental and pathological about our past, and therefore we have put the government in a house. And I mean, like a 17th century townhouse. So, you know, teams split up everywhere, very hard to communicate, very hard to get any major projects done. It's just hard to organize anything in a professional way. He's now set up number 10 North. So, I mean, for ages, constitutional sort of nerds, basically like me and the people that I work with, would say, you need a bigger office of the Prime Minister. You can't do this properly in this way. the mistake that we'd made was we would always wrap our argument up in constitutional nerdery, in good governance, and no one cares about that. What they do care about is geographic justice, the sort of sense of, oh, London centrism, everything's done in London, snobby elites. So Burnham has used the kind of, and I'm not saying he doesn't believe this, but it's a much better narrative than the one that we would have come up with, the kind of populist thing of the London elites, and turned it into, we're going to have number 10 North in Manchester. And by doing that, as long as you cannily divide the operations, he has managed to significantly beef up the political, the government operation, the capacity that is available to him. He has also kind of basically abolished the Cabinet Office, which is this huge bureaucratic lump around number 10 without any real set idea of what it's supposed to be doing. Mostly gotten rid of it, used it to empower the Prime Minister's office. All of that is, look at it this way, it's the kind of thing you would do if you really knew what it was that you wanted to do. And I know that sounds like a very modest bar for someone to hurdle, but it is one that previous prime ministers have really struggled with.
And so he is calling for time, that he needs some time, but that he's going to come up with a 10-year plan. Now, it sounds rather Stalinist, actually, you know, Burnham's 10-year plan. But when are we going to get this? And do you know anything of its shape?
I think we have ideas just by virtue of the values that he speaks about. So, for instance, social care. Like, social care is just a disaster in this country and has not been fixed by a succession of governments because they're so scared. I mean, as soon as you try to fix it, inevitably your opponents say it's a death tax. You're going to put in a death tax and people get scared. It's very easy to scare voters on this basis. It always falls apart. And that's both sides. I mean, Labour tried to do it and the Tories called it a death tax. And Theresa May tried to do it and Labour called it a dementia tax and on you go. He really wants to fix it. And he has come in and he said, I am going to make this one of the cornerstones of my premiership. We're going to fix social care, which does two things, right? I mean, firstly, it does three. It fixes social care. So actually it will help people who end up having to sell their house that they wanted to pass on to the kids to pay for their hair, etc. It would also help the NHS because part of the reason the NHS gets clogged up is because it can't get people off the wards into social care. It's one of the, and that's, you know, on the other side of things, why you then can't get people off accident and emergency onto the wards. I mean, it's a real problem for the NHS. But most importantly is the third aspect, which is it's sort of like defeating populism in its heart. What it says is we can fix seemingly intractable problems. The retail promise of parliamentary democracy, of mainstream politics, of liberalism really, is we are rational, we're non-tribal, we care about all the voters, we see a problem, we fix it. Now, once the system stopped behaving in that way, populism rose. So his commitment to being able to achieve that sort of thing also strikes a dagger into the heart of populism. We don't know what shape, that'll obviously be in the 10-year plan.
Yeah.
And we would expect that probably sometime in the autumn, in the late autumn. We know that something around social care is going to be there. We don't know exactly what it is yet. But his commitment shows you the kind of shape of what that 10-year plan is going to look like, that you're going to reach for these very big problems, you're going to really try and solve them, and you're going to try and take the country with you as you do it. That last part, very, very important indeed.
And Britain has been burning. You've been in the country, haven't you, for what you've ludicrously called a holiday while you've written about six articles here, there and everywhere. but Britain is brown. You haven't had rain. Is that making people, you know, think more seriously about climate change in British politics?
Yeah, I think it is. Look, I have to preface this by saying that I don't think that liberal or progressive politicians have seized on this opportunity as they should have to clearly link, persistently link what people are seeing outside of their homes with the political issue that they read about in their newspapers, net zero, climate change, et cetera. I think there needs to be much more work done on that, that this is a good opportunity to consolidate public opinion. And yet, on the kind of grassroots level and just the sort of civic level, you hear people talking about it. In fact, you hear it deeply imbued in people's sense of what it is. So I think this started about 2-3 years ago when we started getting sort of like temperatures in the high 30s, which just doesn't feel like England. Like, it literally outside on your skin when you step out of the house, it doesn't feel like England on your skin. It feels like something has fundamentally changed. Then you go into the park. I'm next to Hampstead Heath, which is this sort of lush, verdant, green, you know, kind of, I mean, it's just different shades of red and brown. It doesn't look like England anymore. And of course, you know, as the summer goes on, this is how things often look, but not like this. Things look fundamentally different. Then you take, you know, I have a dog, and obviously this being, you know, Britain, most people have a dog. They love dogs here. Well, you can no longer walk your dog during the day. You wake up at 6 a.m. and you walk your dog then, and then, because that's the only time that it's cool enough, and then you wait until about 11:30 at night and you walk your dog then. You don't go out, you don't let that dog out anywhere during the day. So the kind of granular detail of people's lives, their routines, their daily regime, all of that has started to change and in fact reflect what you would see in Spain. That's what people have always done in Spain. Now it's something that people do in England as well. And people do get, this is meaningful. This is something fundamental that is happening. This is proof. I just don't think there's been enough work done amongst the political class to try and enforce that message. It's been happening organically rather than with any assistance from politics.
So nobody is talking about building more windmills and things, but has the right wing, has the populist right wing shut up about the benefits of burning coal and calling for more nuclear power plants?
Absolutely not.
No. It's crucial to them, isn't it?
Well, this is the funny thing. So, of course, Restore and Reform, the two far-right parties, this is the position that they have. And then they base most of their politics. I mean, they're fundamentally very American people. They base all of their political views on American sort of issues. Restore constantly talking about bringing back capital punishment, you know, all of this kind of mad U.S. culture war stuff that doesn't really have any resonance here.
And transsexuals, lots of worries about transsexuals.
Even occasionally they'll say, oh, maybe we could bring guns back. I mean, you just think not speaking to a British audience here. You are completely plugged into US social media and it's going to be a real struggle for you. You know, keep on doing it because it makes it harder for you to win. What's fascinating is what's happening to the Conservative Party. Like under Boris Johnson, a really disreputable prime minister, the Conservative Party were fully pro-action on climate change. He signed up to ambitious targets. He took it seriously. He believed in it. The Conservatives in government had a proud track record on climate change. Now you get to Ken Badenoch leading the Conservative Party, and she is literally telling candidates for the Conservative Party that if they sign up to the net zero agenda, they can no longer be part of the Conservative Party. She is dragging her party away from the centre-right, where there is no competition and plenty of, you know, fiscally conservative, socially liberal voters for you to attract, and moving them right over to the far-right so it can compete with two other parties who are already pretty strong there. And not only is that stupid, obviously, on a strategic level, but it's also stupid tactically, because she has decided to make this case, to make this argument, and to undertake these changes right in the middle of a succession of heat waves when people are least open to your climate skeptic attitudes. If she had any sense about her at all, you know, putting aside the fact that she clearly has no moral compass, she would do this in winter where people are less receptive to the arguments. But fool that she is, she has decided that this is the right time. So unfortunately, no, it's sort of the worst of both worlds, really. On the one hand, you have progressive politicians not making the link. And on the other, you have right-wing politicians who don't pay any attention to it at all and still push ahead with their climate skepticism. Mercifully, though, on this issue, and it is not the case for all issues, there are many issues in which the British public are incredibly foolish, but on this issue, the British public, I mean, I suspect maybe because they watch a lot of David Attenborough, you know, documentaries, and he talks about it a lot, ahead of the politicians and are pretty solid in their views of what stuff is happening.
Ian, thank you once again for joining us on the show. I've been speaking to Ian Dunt, who is a columnist with iNews. And by the way, why not read iNews? You can get him even before you hear him here. You can get iNews from Australia, you know. He's also the co-host of the Origin Story podcast. Now, coming up, the Odyssey hits trouble in Morocco. Morocco is a great place to film. The King's a fan. His army is there to give filmmakers a helping hand. There are generous tax concessions. And to top it all off, the scenery is fabulous. So in one sense, it's no surprise that Christopher Nolan took his cameras to Morocco to film part of the Odyssey. The trouble is, one of the locations he chose there to film was a stretch of Western Sahara, which, under international law, is not Morocco at all, but occupied by Morocco. By Nolan doing so, he's been accused of ignoring Morocco's ongoing violence against the indigenous people of that region, the Sahrawi people. One of Nolan's critics is Sarah Yerkes of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she's a North Africa specialist and a senior fellow in the Middle East program. And Sarah joins us now. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Sarah, what is the story here? What is the international standing of this chunk of what Morocco claims to be Morocco, but isn't?
Well, it's definitely still very much disputed. So under international law, you know, the UN, the EU High Court of Justice, it's considered non-self-governing territory, meaning that it's really occupied by Morocco. But according to Morocco, as well as to a growing number of countries, including the United States, Western Sahara is part of Morocco. Morocco has sovereignty. But this is a situation that has not been settled. It certainly has not been settled by international law. And the Sahrawi people themselves certainly do not feel like they are part of Morocco today.
And what is the record for the Sahrawi people under Moroccan occupation?
So the Sahrawi people have basically suffered quite a lot of human rights violations. One of the challenges is that there is a virtual media blackout. So journalists who try to go and report on what's happening there are prohibited from doing so. You know, we don't have a ton of information, but there are human rights organizations that have managed to get on the ground and to speak with Sahrawis. And what we see is that the Sahrawi people don't have control over their own resources. They don't have control over their own territory. And we see a growing number of human rights violations against them, as well as in broader Morocco.
So when Nolan took his cameras there, was there no one to warn him of this difficult territory?
No, I mean, it's pretty easy to figure out that this was going to be a controversial idea. Anyone who looks at, here's Google Western Sahara, and you can figure out that this is an area that has not been settled, that there's a group of people who live there, who have lived there forever, who, you know, don't have their own rights. And furthermore, you know, there is the Sahrawi people are represented by a government. The Polisario is their organization that supports them. They consider it the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic. And there's a lot of NGOs that work on this issue. So there's no reason for Nolan to say, oh, I didn't know what was happening. And Western Sahara itself has its own organization called Fee Sahara, which is a film festival that has been very, very vocal about the situation. They've asked Nolan not to film there. They asked him to reconsider when he did start filming. And since the film has come out, they've asked for a boycott against the film.
Do we know at all what Nolan's attitude was to these pleas to him not to use that area?
We really don't, because he's been completely silent. And I think this is, again, where he has failed. You know, it's obviously his decision. He can film wherever he wants to film. But the fact that this was pointed out to him when he had time to stop it, you know, he could have easily spoken out at the time, you know, when this was pointed out to him that, look, you shouldn't be filming here. And if you're going to film here, you're going to be contributing to an occupation, to a colonialization of this territory. He could have gone on the record and either said, this is why I'm choosing to ignore that, or, you know, said, I recognize the rights of the Sahrawi people, or made some sort of concession to the Sahrawi people to allow them to benefit from this mega film. But instead, he's been completely silent on this. And I think that's where he is complicit in this.
Do we know whether Sahrawi people did benefit from the filming there?
There's been no reporting saying that they have. You know, what we don't know is whether or not individual Sahrawis participated in the film. It's possible some of them were extras or were on the crew. But the Sahrawi people in general do not benefit from the Moroccan national government. You know, the film industry in Morocco is very tightly controlled, very centralized, controlled by the Moroccan government, who reaps all the rewards from this sort of film. That money does not trickle down to the local Sahrawi people. The Sahrawi people have not been given any sort of concessions publicly about any of this. And they've spoken out very vociferously that they were not consulted as to whether or not this territory should be used in the film and whether or not, you know, their own land should be used. So as far as we know, they have not received any benefit from this.
Tell us about this attitude of the Moroccans to the film industry. What is it that they want from making Morocco such an attractive place to film?
So I would say, you know, overall, I very much applaud what Morocco has done to make itself this really attractive film destination. You know, they have been really actively courting film and television productions for many years. They have a lot of generous incentives that they offer, including tax breaks. You mentioned the military. There's also a cash rebate on expenses. So they've done a good job in that sense. They've also done a really good job at trying to bring up local Moroccans. They have programs to support local filmmakers. They have, you know, increasing number of professional training schools so that Moroccans themselves benefit from film productions. That is all well and good. The challenge is that that doesn't then flow down to Western Sahara. And one of the things that's important about the Odyssey, you know, this is obviously a huge major summer blockbuster. It's something that has, you know, generated a ton of media attention. And that is, it's on purpose that is being filmed in Dakhla. From the Moroccan perspective, they have actively courted Hollywood productions to come and film in Western Sahara for many years. This is the first one to do so. And the Moroccan government has been very clear. They said, we really hope that the Odyssey opens the door to other Hollywood films being filmed in Western Sahara so that this can become a trend, not just an anomaly.
What is it about the Western Sahara that is so attractive to filmmakers? I mean, is the landscape particularly fabulous?
I mean, yes and no. It's beautiful, and it's on the coast, on the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. The country of Morocco is on both coasts. So it does evoke these same sorts of views. When you think of Greece, when you think of the Odyssey, it makes sense that you would film in these locations. But there's nothing particular about Dakhla. Dakhla is not, Western Sahara is not connected to the Odyssey in the text. There's nothing particular about Dakhla that would have you film there. You know, you easily could have gotten these same vistas in Morocco proper.
Which episode of the film are we talking about? Do you know?
You know, honestly, I have not seen the film because I am boycotting the film myself. So I don't know exactly which scenes. It's 4 days out of 90 days that are filmed there. So, and it's not like, you know, they go and say, we are now in Western Sahara. I mean, intentionally, it's not meant to. It's not supposed to be taking place in Western Sahara. So I'm not sure which of the scenes. I mean, they are, Western Sahara is, you know, beautiful cliffs and things like that. So one of the vistas. But, you know, this film was also 90 days of filming. This is 4 out of those 90 days. It was filmed in 9 different countries. So there's quite a bit of variety of location that Nolan chose to film in.
Sarah, is there something exaggerated about this concern? I mean, yes, the people of this little chunk of land disputed between Morocco and themselves are having a really rough time. They shouldn't be. A film company comes there for 4 days. There's no record of them actually making life harder for those people. Some of them may well have had some employment. We don't really know that. And then the film company moves on. It's not as though they've done harm, have they? Has Nolan done harm?
I mean, I would say in a way, yes, that, you know, one of the things that he has done is to normalize Moroccan control over Western Sahara. And, you know, one of the things that's really sad is that actually today we're closer perhaps to a negotiated settlement to this conflict than we ever have been. There's been quite a bit of negotiations going on between Morocco, between the Polisario, Algeria. The United States is very much involved in this, as well as some European countries. And, you know, there's a chance that they could reach a deal that would provide the Sahrawi people with real rights. And that deal could happen as soon as this fall. The UN is the main body that's overtaking these negotiations. So it's sad in a way that they couldn't just wait until this is a settled deal in order to, you know, bring the film industry there. But I think as far as the harm question goes, this idea that you would just ignore international law and kind of trample on the rights of people without acknowledging the hardship that they do face, without acknowledging the real and serious human rights violations that the people face, first of all, is just not good practice, but second of all, goes against what Nolan was purportedly trying to do with this film. You know, he claims he based his interpretation on the translation by Emily Wilson, who is the first woman to translate the Odyssey. Yeah. Her translation really foregrounds these ideas of colonialism, of marginalization, you know, brings the rights of enslaved people back onto the screen. You know, this is something that Nolan set out to do very admirably. But what he's doing is actually trampling the rights of indigenous people and colonialized people in his own film. And so I think not only is it just wrong on a moral sense, but it's also wrong for the purpose of the film he set out to create in his own words.
And Emily Wilson, the translator, is one of those who've raised their voices to criticize the filming there and criticize it strongly. Not quite as strongly, perhaps, as she criticized the film itself. Boy, did she give it a stinker of a review.
Yeah, she was. She really went after it, and she got a lot of pushback herself. But I do think, you know, it is notable that she called out Western Sahara specifically, as I think she said that was one of the, you know, the worst things that this film did. But, you know, and it's not just her. We've seen as more people have become aware. I mean, this really was not something most of the world was aware of.
No.
Prior to the film. But it's becoming more and more. I mean, I can say personally, as someone sitting in Washington, D.C., that, you know, getting to speak to you and getting to speak to people around the world, there, you know, more and more people are becoming aware of just what happened. And I think that's the positive side of this, if there is one, that perhaps people who've never heard of Western Sahara, you know, are starting to learn about it. And so that certainly was not Nolan's intention, but that could be maybe a silver lining, is that the situation of Sahrawis is starting to take on, you know, more awareness around the world.
Mm. I mean, as you say, we would not be talking about this subject, but for this little issue. This is Radio National, Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Sarah Yerkes about the problem of the filming of the Odyssey in this contested corner of Morocco, or not Morocco, according to the people who live there. Sarah, I can't have you on the station without asking you what you know about this mass arrival of people into the Spanish territory. They're Moroccans, aren't they? Sort of 40,000 of them or something that went over the border into the Spanish territory?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this has been quite a news story as well. I think there are, you know, something between 50 and 60,000 people, the majority of them Moroccans, who had a coordinated effort, it looks like, to storm the border. There's two Spanish enclaves that sit inside Moroccan territory, Ceuta and Melilla. This is in Ceuta. And, you know, this is not the first time there have been these sort of coordinated mass migration attempts. But normally, you know, what's different this time is that these are Moroccans who are trying to leave their country because of unemployment, because of lack of opportunity. Normally, when these border incursions happen, it's sub-Saharan African migrants who are, you know, using Morocco as a transit point, who aren't ever intending to stay in Morocco. But this time it's Moroccans. And I think this just shows you how desperate so many people in Morocco are that they'd be willing to risk their lives. And we've seen, I think the latest numbers are something around 60 to 70 people are dead because of this, you know, either from most of them from drowning at sea, trying to make it there. This is a very, very sad and quite dangerous situation.
What's happened to those people? Do you know, have they returned to Morocco?
Most of them have returned. You know, what happened is those who made it in have found that there's no place for them to go. Ceuta is a little tiny enclave, and it's just because you're there. I mean, you're technically in Europe, but then you still have to get to mainland Europe. And so most of the people, you know, have not been able to take that second step and have decided it's not worth it and have returned home. And because they're Moroccans, they can do that. You know, the sub-Saharan Africans who try to make this similar journey, they can't necessarily just easily go back to Morocco because they're not supposed to be in Morocco.
Is Morocco in crisis of some kind at the moment?
You know, the general situation is that the economic situation has been deteriorating, that there's a lot of Moroccans who can't find work, who can't afford to feed themselves and their families, and just feel this desperation. And for them, you know, Europe is right there. It signifies a better life. There's a large Moroccan diaspora in Europe. And so people see their friends and families that have better opportunities in their minds. And so, you know, you're seeing this real sense of desperation, the people who say, I'm willing to risk my life for this journey at sea, which is a very dangerous journey. It shows that level of desperation.
What's the state of democracy like in Morocco?
Morocco is a constitutional monarchy, which means it's, you know, it's very much a monarchy, but they have a constitution, but it's not a democracy. I mean, there's, you know, very little that's decided, and pretty much everything has to go through the king. So they do have a parliament that has some powers, but there's not a lot of real voice for the people. And there's been quite a bit of crackdown on any sort of opposition to the government, any sort of opposition to the king. So it's not the kind of place where you can really speak freely.
Yeah. And the king is a great enthusiast, as I understand it, for the film industry.
He is. Yeah. He has been one of the big backers of the film industry, which is why it has been so successful. You know, that is the one thing about, the nice thing about a monarchy, I guess, is, you know, if the king supports you, you get all the resources you need. And so that has been great for this burgeoning film industry.
I was interested in one detail there, that that the Moroccan armed forces are available to lend a hand for filmmakers. That must be hugely valuable.
Yes, and it's very rare. I mean, from my understanding, that's not something that happens in most places. And so Morocco really, you know, they've rolled out the red carpet to anyone who wants to come there. You know, and I do hope that the film industry continues to grow. I hope that they do give more voice to the Moroccan people, but I just hope they stay out of Western Sahara, at least until this is a settled conflict.
Do you think that this crisis, this controversy, is going to do anything to knock back the film industry generally in Morocco?
I don't think so. I mean, I hope that it will help Hollywood directors and others think twice about filming there. I don't think it's going to harm the Moroccan film industry writ large.
Right. Okay. And isn't it time we both went and saw The Odyssey? I know you're not going to because you're boycotting it. I haven't been yet because I just don't have the time. It takes about half a day, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, that's what I've heard from friends who've seen it, that it's very long and it's very loud. So I will say to anyone who's listening who wants to go see it, my good friend who once said, bring earplugs, because it shakes your seat. And So it's not my type of film anyway, but plenty of people are going to see it. They're not going to miss my dollars anyway.
I don't think. Long, loud, and from its experience in Morocco, clumsy. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I have been talking to Sarah Yerkes about the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, about the uproar that has been produced by the Odyssey filming in that contested stretch of Morocco. Coming up, the unpopular cats of Kangaroo Island. After years of trapping, there are a few feral cats left on Kangaroo Island. So things are looking up for the island's bandicoots, echidnas, dunnarts, little penguins, hooded plovers and western whipbirds. But house cats are still free to roam and kill. Now, though the cat lovers of Radio National have begged Late Night Live not to go here, we are. To celebrate the work Kangaroo Island has already done to rid the place of wild cats, and the plans it has to get rid of the pets too. It's called the Last Cat Policy. And here to explain what's going on is the Mayor of Kangaroo Island, Michael Pengilly. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, good evening, David, and good evening to all your listeners.
Mate, I have been told you have been the Mayor of Kangaroo Island forever. How long is forever?
No, it's been nearly 8 years, David. I was actually in Parliament for 12 years before that, and I went there from doing 3 years as mayor. So it might seem like forever, but it's not.
An addiction, mate, to public office.
I think you have to be a little bit mad to do it, but there you go.
But there you go, and thank goodness for people such as yourselves. Michael, Kangaroo Island was blessed, wasn't it? Because no rabbits ever got there.
Well, rabbits actually were brought here, David. about 100 years ago, there were some rabbits introduced round near Sapphire Town on the eastern end, but the goannas wiped them out. The goannas ate a lot. You'd be pleased about that. So they got rid of the rabbits, but we've never had foxes here. No dingoes, of course. So we have been lucky in that respect. We've had a few other
introduced species.
Yes, we had deer. We've got rid of them.
Goats.
Yes, goats. We got rid of them.
Pigs.
Yep, we got rid of them.
Cats.
Cats, but I'll also add that koalas are introduced species here, and they're a feral species as well, sadly, but they're not on the mainland, of course. So, but cats are the big one at the moment, David. We're concentrating on Dudley Peninsula on the east end to rid that of cats, make that cat free. We've had a lot of support. Costs a lot of money. The farming community are right behind it, the environmentalists. So they're shaking hands together, which is great. So we're out to get them.
So any idea of the numbers of feral cats that are left on the peninsula?
Very few, David, as far as I know. I think it's down to sort of, you know, under 100. And they're hoping to clean them up. We've just had some more funding put into that federally, and the state government is supportive. So once they're cleaned up, and it's not granny's cats, I've got to say that, in
no.
the town of Penetshaw or anywhere. These are feral cats. Bearing in mind that the minute your cat goes outside and jumps the fence, it's feral, David. Everyone needs to remember that. But well on the way to getting it. It's been fantastically successful. The architect of a lot of that is a fellow called Paul Jennings, who's got these coon hunting dogs from America, they're called. He's my neighbour down the road. I'm actually about 60 k's away from Dudley Peninsula, but he's got 100 cats on our property in the last year or so.
Right. So once the peninsula is dealt with, then the rest of the island you're going to be looking at for feral cats?
Absolutely. That will take decades, at least, you know, a couple of decades at the very minimum, I would think. We're the third largest island of Australia, and there's a lot of country there, about a third of its national parks. So it'll have to be a pretty determined sort of strategy to rid them on that area. I don't think I'll live to see it, David, at my age, but I look forward to future generations having a completely cat-free island.
Is there any sign on the peninsula of native life coming back now that the cat numbers have been cut down so severely?
Yes, absolutely, David. There's, as you mentioned earlier, bandicoots, grey bandicoots are back, brown bandicoots, I'll get it right in a minute, sorry. Yes, there's some of them been put back and they're starting to thrive. But what it has saved is a lot of the native birds, lizards, insects, all sorts of things that these things, they're voracious, they'll eat anything, and when they do get them and destroy them, they open them up to see what they've had, and they're just full of, you know, full of native animals and birds. Just horrendous.
Yeah, but they also spread disease, don't they, to sheep?
Yes, they do. Toxoplasmosis is one of the diseases that sheep get, which affects the meat and their breeding cycles, the whole lot. So what we find with one of the sheep diseases is when they go to the abattoirs, they actually have to cut that little bit of infected meat out, trim it. So if we can get rid of feral cats, get rid of that disease, it's great for agriculture. It's good all round. It's a perfect scenario for farming and the environment. So we just need to get rid of every wretched feral cat on the island as quick as possible, David.
But then there are the pet cats. How jealously guarded are the pet cats? I mean, I can't imagine the owners of pet cats, you know, offering up their animals.
Well, they won't. And that's not, we don't intend to persecute them in any way, shape or form, and the animals won't live forever. People don't live forever. So it'd be an education program to slowly, you know, encourage people not to have pet cats, not to get them, not to breed cats, whatever. Look, most people are responsible owners with cats. There are those that are irresponsible. We have one particular cat on the East End that's been seen, and it's got a collar and a bell. It's still out there. It's been seen in about 10 different cameras in the area, and it's running on a short fuse at the moment. I can assure you that, David.
Can't you just shoot domestic cats that are out there hunting native animals? Just warn their owners if they're seen out there plundering the native wildlife, we'll shoot them.
Yeah, well, not in the towns you can't, but there's absolutely nothing to say you can't do it. I can tell you here, you know, I shoot them. If my dogs, we've got a couple of border collies that are pretty useless at everything except getting cats up trees. If they put a cat up a tree, I shoot it. I make no bones about it.
Fair enough. Are cats bred on the island?
Well, they still are, but they shouldn't be. Ultimately, in your lead up, you talked about last cat policy. That's what we want to get put in place here.
Yeah, let's explain that.
Well, that is a means to an end in putting that in place to gradually reduce the cats. It needs to go through the parliament, an act of parliament to assist us to get that in place. Local government can't do that. So we're very actively pursuing it, talking with ministers and whatnot. I think the cabinet's over here for a love-in or something in a couple of weeks overnight, and they're going to meet with council. We'll be talking to them about the last cap policy. We really want to pursue it. If we don't get to put it in place in the life of our council, I'm sure future councils will, because we're very environmentally conscious on the island. And we want to see it thrive. So that's just something that we're going to try and aim for. That's the ideal, is to have a last cat policy and a last cat gone, done.
But Michael, what will you be asking Parliament for? You'll be asking Parliament for a law that says you cannot own a cat on Kangaroo Island, aren't you?
We used to have a law which said you could not have Alsatian dogs on Kangaroo Island some years ago. And then somebody had an Alsatian, was a friend of the minister of the day, and they got it changed to allow them here. So there's nothing to stop legislation being put through to forbid cats on Kangaroo Island, as same as there is currently with rabbits and foxes. You're forbidden to bring them here. So, you know, it's not a difficult process. Unfortunately, you've got a group of people who've got their right to love cats or whatever, but the answer to it is to put this thing in place, and the ideal is to have a cat-free island, David. It's as simple as that.
But do you reckon the Manolakis government will have the courage to do that? I mean, it's going to get a lot of people's backs up.
Oh, look, I think the current government would have the courage to do it. I really do, and I think the parliament would do it. Now, they've got the numbers in the lower house. They haven't got the ideal numbers in the upper house. But my reading of the situation would be that if such a bill was to go through the upper house or introduce the upper house, it'd get up, and then the government would be hard-pressed, in my humble view, to say no in the lower house where they've got a big majority. If they want to push the environment, if they want to seem to be carers for the environment, putting a last cap policy in place on Kangaroo Island would be an ideal way to pursue that.
You could, of course, give a conscience vote, couldn't you, to members of Parliament, as if it was, you know, euthanasia or gay marriage or something like this. You could just, you know, let all members, you know, look to their own consciences and see whether or not cats could be forbidden in an area of Australia.
Yes, you could. I wouldn't have to worry about that. I have no conscience whatsoever in getting rid of feral cats, David, so I'm probably just as well I'm not there. I'd speak strongly in favour of it. But they could have, but I doubt whether they would do that.
Michael, we're enjoying good news about the cats, but at the same time, I understand that bird flu has reached Kangaroo Island.
Yes, it has. We've had positive cases found on Kangaroo Island, a couple on the north coast, many on the south coast. It's a clear run on the south coast straight through to Antarctica. And, of course, the birds migrate. They move back and forth, the petrels, the crested terns, all sorts of birds that go back and forth. And they've been discovered on Seal Bay, which is the greatest attraction on the island for visitation from domestics and internationals. There's been more discovered in the last day or so, so I think we're in for a very rough trot, David. We've been through fires, been through COVID, been through algal bloom. We've got the fear of varroa mite in the bees, and now we've got bloody bird flu, excuse me.
How come it's not arrived sooner?
I don't know. It's a miracle. Australia is a standalone continent, largest island in the world, smallest continent. It's a miracle that it hasn't, but it would appear that we're going to go through it. I think it's determined really the impact will be by how long it hangs around. I'm told that in California a few years ago it arrived there and it was only there for about 6 weeks and it disappeared. But the carnage that it can do on our native species and our poultry and things like that is enormous. So, you know, we'd rather not have it. We've got it. We've got to deal with it. We've actually got a forum with tourism operators on Friday, talking through with them. We're putting up quite a bit of advertising about trying to encourage people, if they see a dead bird, not to pick it up on the beach.
Do not touch it.
Don't touch it. We've got 520 kilometres of coastline here, a lot of it inaccessible. So it's only the accessible places where they'll see dead birds. So they're encouraged to actually take a photo, pinpoint it, and send it. Send a message to the authorities to get it. They'll come and bag it up. Even taking a dog for a walk and running across a dead bird, it can gravitate to the dogs, cause the infection to be moved. People walking around, if it's on the beach, for example, could pick it up on their shoes. That's why Seal Bay has stopped the beach tours. They're doing tours, guided tours off the boardwalks, so you actually don't have to walk on the beach. They'll be able to see plenty of animals that are up in the sand hills in this cooler weather anyway. So we're going to try everything we can to limit the effect. I did hear today that it's down in the Coorong wetlands now. So, look, I don't know where it's going to end, David. It's rather horrendous, but there's no point wringing your hands and, you know, throwing them up in the air again. We've just got to deal with it, get on with it and come out the other side and then try and restore some equilibrium and health to our bird species and animal species, whatever it gets into.
But meanwhile, Michael, I will have in my mind a picture of you on a moonlit night out there with your rifle and a couple of dogs chasing cats with collars and bells that have made the mistake of hunting in the dark.
You're a dreadful man. Well, Charlie and Plugger actually sleep pretty soundly at night. They don't do far at all.
Rouse them, man. Rouse them.
No. I'll be doing everything I can to rid our property of feral cats at any given time, David. Trust me.
But any cats? I thought you drew no distinction between the feral and the pet.
We haven't got a pet. We've never had a pet cat, and I never will have a pet cat. So, yeah, these two brutes that are standing by me on the veranda are enough for us.
Very sound man, I think, Michael. Very sound. I have been speaking to Michael Pengilly, Mayor of Kangaroo Island, about the cats and the flu. Michael, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much, David, and let's get rid of them.
Good man. And that's the show. On our next, Bernard Keane. For nearly 20 years, Bernard Keane's been the Canberra voice of the independent daily newsletter, Crikey. He knows politics inside out. He is unsparing. You've heard him here on Late Night Live because we love having him on. And he's back to discuss his new book, Seize the Moment, Australia's Real Opportunities in an Unstable World. That's next.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.